Are we alone in the universe? Few questions have stirred the human imagination more deeply than this. Are we alone in the universe? From the first moment we looked up at the night sky, the sheer immensity of it has demanded an answer. The universe we inhabit is vast beyond comprehension, hundreds of billions of galaxies, each with billions of stars, each potentially surrounded by planets. Logic seems almost insulted by the suggestion that life, the spark of consciousness and curiosity, has emerged only once in all this cosmic abundance. And yet, science, our most disciplined method of understanding reality, has treated the question of extraterrestrial life with remarkable caution, even suspicion. In most domains, science follows a simple and powerful sequence: observation, hypothesis, falsification. We observe a phenomenon, propose an explanation, and then test it. But when it comes to life elsewhere in the cosmos, this sequence has been quietly inverted. Instead of hypothesizing that life is likely and seeking to falsify that claim, the scientific mainstream has often adopted the opposite stance, to assume that we are alone unless incontrovertible evidence proves otherwise. This inversion is not scientific necessity but cultural inheritance. For much of human history, our worldviews, philosophical, religious, and even scientific, have placed humanity at the center of creation. From the geocentric universe of antiquity to the theological insistence on human uniqueness, we have been conditioned to see ourselves as exceptional, even cosmically singular. Though modern science has long since displaced Earth from the physical center of the universe, a subtle form of anthropocentrism still lingers in our intellectual reflexes. The absence of direct evidence for extraterrestrial life is treated not as a temporary gap in data, but as silent confirmation of our solitude. Yet logic, probability, and the very principles of scientific reasoning point in another direction. The same chemistry that produced life on Earth is universal. The same physical laws govern distant galaxies. Wherever conditions resemble those of early Earth, liquid water, stable energy sources, organic molecules, the emergence of life is not miraculous but expected. In a universe of such scale and diversity, the odds overwhelmingly favor the existence of life elsewhere, perhaps microbial, perhaps intelligent, perhaps unimaginably alien. The real tension, then, is not between science and speculation, but between logic and legacy. Science, in its purest form, should be open to possibility, guided by evidence, but not confined by historical sentiment or cultural comfort. The question of extraterrestrial life challenges not only our technology but our philosophy of inquiry itself. It forces us to confront how deeply our human story still shapes what we allow ourselves to believe. In what follows, we will explore that question across scientific, philosophical, and cultural dimensions, from the physics of habitable worlds to the psychology of fear, from the numbers that promise company to the silence that still surrounds us. The Goldilocks Zone, more than distance. When astronomers speak of a planet's habitability, the term that often appears first is the Goldilocks Zone, that narrow band around a star where conditions are just right for liquid water to exist on a planet's surface. Too close to the star, and water boils away; too far, and it freezes. In quantitative terms, this translates into roughly 1,000 watts per square meter of stellar radiation, the amount Earth receives from the Sun. But this simple picture, while elegant, is profoundly incomplete. The Goldilocks Zone is not a single line drawn around a star. It is a dynamic, multidimensional balance. Habitability depends not just on where a planet is, but what it is, its mass, atmosphere, internal heat, and geochemical history. A planet can orbit at the perfect distance and still be utterly inhospitable. Take Venus, for instance, our so-called sister planet. It lies within the classical habitable zone of the Sun. Its distance from our star is not dramatically different from Earth's, and early in the 20th century, some even imagined it might host lush jungles beneath its perpetual clouds. The reality could not be more different. Venus is too massive and possesses a thick, carbon dioxide-rich atmosphere. This dense envelope traps solar heat through a runaway greenhouse effect, pushing surface temperatures to nearly 470 degrees Celsius, 880 degrees Fahrenheit, hot enough to melt lead. The crushing atmospheric pressure, more than 90 times that of Earth's, prevents any cooling through convection or radiation. In essence, Venus is a planet that never managed to shed its primordial heat. Its very size and atmospheric density doomed it to a permanent fever. Venus reminds us that being in the zone means little if the planet's physical parameters amplify rather than regulate heat. Habitability, therefore, is not a single criterion, it is a delicate interplay between stellar input and planetary response. On the other side of the solar comfort zone lies Mars, smaller, colder, and desolate. With only about a tenth of Earth's mass, Mars lacks the gravity to hold on to a thick atmosphere. Over billions of years, solar winds stripped away much of its gaseous envelope, leaving behind a thin veil of carbon dioxide. With little atmospheric insulation, surface heat escapes freely into space, and the planet has largely frozen over. Ironically, Mars cooled faster than Earth because of its smaller size. In its youth, this rapid cooling meant that it may have entered a habitable phase before Earth did. Geological and chemical evidence supports this idea. Ancient riverbeds, deltas, and mineral formations tell a story of once flowing water. The discovery of iron oxides, rust, essentially, gives us circumstantial but tantalizing hints of an oxygen cycle, and possibly even biological activity. Mars, in short, may once have been the first world in our solar system to harbor life, even if only briefly. Between Venus's inferno and Mars's deep freeze lies Earth, the improbable middle ground where temperature, mass, and atmosphere align in a near-perfect equilibrium. This balance is fragile. Alter Earth's size, its orbital distance, or the composition of its air by even modest degrees, and the conditions for life as we know it would vanish. This realization has reshaped our search for life beyond the solar system. Astronomers now look for Earth analogs, planets not only at the right distance from their stars, but also with the right mass, atmospheric chemistry, and internal dynamics. The ideal planet must cool at the right rate, recycle its gases through volcanism and plate tectonics, and maintain a stable climate long enough for life to emerge. In other words, habitability is not a fixed property of a planet's orbit, it is an evolving state, the product of cosmic balance and geological time. The lesson of our own solar system is humbling. Out of three terrestrial planets that began with roughly similar ingredients and orbits, Venus, Earth, and Mars, only one remains habitable today. The others, despite meeting the textbook definition of being in the Goldilocks zone, became victims of their own physical parameters. If life does exist elsewhere in the universe, it must inhabit worlds where countless such factors have aligned, worlds that, like Earth, have found and maintained that fleeting balance between too much and too little, too hot and too cold, too small and too large. The Goldilocks zone, then, is not merely a location in space, it is a condition of harmony between star and planet, between energy and matter, and perhaps between chance and inevitability. The vastness of the universe. Our galaxy, the Milky Way, contains between 200 and 400 billion stars, and nearly all of them host planets. Even if only 1% of these stars possess an Earth-like world, that still yields billions of potential abodes for life in our galaxy alone. Beyond it lie 2 trillion galaxies in the observable universe. The numbers exceed comprehension, and with them, the likelihood that Earth is unique grows infinitesimal. The Copernican principle tells us that we are not central. Statistically, we are not exceptional either. Yet we have found no definitive proof of life elsewhere. The vastness that makes life probable also makes it elusive. Even for our nearest neighbor, Proxima Centauri, 4 light-years away, an Earth-like planet would appear billions of times dimmer than its star, a firefly orbiting a searchlight. In that immensity, silence is not surprising. It is expected. Listening to the stars. If life elsewhere is likely, then intelligent life, capable of communication, should have left traces. That hope inspired the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI, to scan the skies for radio signals that nature would never produce. In the 20th century, Earth itself was a radio beacon. Television, radar, and radio transmitters blasted megawatt signals into space, easily detectable from light years away. Early SETI scientists assumed other civilizations might do the same. Hence, the search for narrowband signals near the hydrogen line at 1,420 MHz. But our planet is growing quieter. Fiber optics, satellites, and digital networks have replaced high-power broadcasting. What once was a bright planetary shout is now a whisper. The radio phase of our civilization may last barely a century, a blink in cosmic time. If others evolve similarly, their detectable windows may never overlap with ours. We may be surrounded by voices, but speaking at the wrong time, in the wrong way, on channels we no longer share. Counting the voices in the dark. In 1961, astronomer Frank Drake proposed a framework to estimate how many civilizations might exist in our galaxy capable of communication. N equals R underscore, times F underscore P, times N underscore E, times F underscore L, times F underscore I, times F underscore C, times L. Each term narrows the field. from the rate of star formation, R, to the fraction with planets, FP, to those inhabitable zones, Ni, to the planets where life arises, FL, intelligence evolves, Phi, technology emerges, F underscore C, and finally, how long such civilizations remain detectable, L. Drake's early optimism assumed that civilizations would broadcast powerful radio signals, perhaps for millennia. But our own loud phase is already fading, and the final term, L, the lifetime of detectability, may be tragically short. If our window is a few hundred years in a galaxy billions of years old, it is no wonder we have not yet heard another voice. The equation was never meant to give a final number. It was meant to remind us what we do not know, and to show that even in uncertainty, the universe is likely full of others trying, as we are, to be heard. Shouting into the dark. For decades, our radio leakage was accidental, the unintended byproduct of communication. But now, some scientists have proposed METI, messaging extraterrestrial intelligence, intentionally sending powerful, structured signals to nearby stars, announcing that we are here. Supporters argue that silence is self-defeating, that if everyone listens but no one speaks, the galaxy will remain forever mute. Critics, however, warn of danger. We do not know who might be listening. The caution voiced by Stephen Hawking, that shouting into a dark jungle invites unknown predators, echoes a much older fear, that contact between unequal powers tends to end badly for the weaker one. The debate reveals a profound ambivalence. We yearn to know we are not alone, yet we hesitate to risk being known. Our technology makes us capable of cosmic communication, but our history makes us cautious. The question is no longer whether we can send a message, but whether we should. Reflections on power and fear. Our hesitation to reach out is not born of superstition, but of memory. When we fear that alien contact might lead to conquest, we are really recalling our own past. Western civilizations' encounters with the unknown, the Native Americans, the Aboriginal peoples of Australia, the Africans under colonial rule, and today, the Palestinian people, reveal a consistent pattern: domination justified as enlightenment, curiosity turned to control. The language of discovery has often concealed the reality of exploitation. Thus, when we imagine aliens as conquerors, we are projecting ourselves onto the cosmos. The others we fear resemble the ones we once were. Our fear is a mirror. The ethics of contact, therefore, begin on Earth. Before we can meet another intelligence among the stars, we must learn to meet one another with dignity. The measure of our readiness for cosmic company is our capacity for empathy, not our technology. Perhaps the universe has remained silent not because it is empty, but because civilizations that survive long enough to communicate have learned discretion, patience, and humility. If that is so, the silence may be an act of wisdom. A message returned. After all the probabilities and fears, we arrive at a more hopeful vision, one captured in Carl Sagan's Contact. When a structured signal arrives from Vega, humanity learns that it is not alone. The message includes instructions for building a machine that allows a single traveler, Dr. Eli Arroway, to journey through a network of wormholes and meet the senders. The encounter is not a conquest, but a conversation, not a warning, but an embrace. Arroway's story embodies the best of us: courage tempered by humility, reason guided by wonder. The aliens she meets do not dominate, they guide. They remind us that survival, at a cosmic scale, may depend not on power but on cooperation. Their message is simple: we have all struggled. We have all endured. You are not alone. Eli Arroway was inspired by Dr. Jill Tarter, a real-life astronomer who co-founded the SETI Institute and dedicated her career to listening for voices among the stars. Sagan knew Tarter personally and based Arroway's intellect and resolve on her. At a time when women in science faced immense barriers, Tarter's perseverance was itself an act of quiet revolution. She once said, "We are the mechanism by which the cosmos can know itself." That sentence captures the heart of both her work and Sagan's vision, that the search for others is also a way for the universe to become self-aware through us. Sagan's story, and Tarter's life, offer an alternative to our anxieties. They suggest that knowledge and empathy may evolve together, that civilizations capable of surviving long enough to reach the stars must first learn compassion. Perhaps the silence we hear is not emptiness, but grace, the respectful quiet of civilizations waiting for us to grow wise enough to join the conversation. Every telescope turned to the sky is also a mirror reflecting inward. In listening for others, we listen for the best within ourselves, the hope that intelligence can coexist with kindness, that life can reach beyond survival to meaning. If the universe ever answers back, it may not be with instructions or warnings, but with affirmation. You are part of something greater. Keep listening. Whether the signal comes tomorrow or in 1,000 years, the search itself already defines us. It proves that, even in our smallness, we dare to hope. Because the question, are we alone, has never really been about them. It has always been about us, about who we are, and who we still might become.